It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Kashimu Evans is our guest today. He was a key member of Kentucky's national championship team in 1998, played 2 years for the Wildcats after transferring from Manhattan College, and was the second leading scorer for Kentucky in his senior year, 1998-99. He went on to a long professional basketball career, most of it in Portugal, but also in France, Japan, Spain, and Angola. So he has a lot of experience traveling and living in other countries, and we'll talk to him about that today, too. First of all, Kashimu, welcome. Good to have you with us today.
Hey, Keith, it's a pleasure. It's good to be here.
Now, you are back in Lexington now. Tell us, before we begin to look back a little bit, tell us what you're doing currently.
Currently, well, I'm back here, and I'm excited because I have a group. It's called the Players Sports Group, and we're going to bring some great stuff for the state of Kentucky. We're going to do some touring around the state with basketball camps, and we're really going to focus on details and giving these kids the quality training and basketball knowledge that I received throughout the years. I'm super excited about it. You know, we're putting it together as we speak, actually. So I'm excited about that.
Mm-hmm. So that's on the way right now, and you mentioned working with young people, and I would assume it's going to be about more than basketball in the sense that you'll be passing along some things about living and growing up and that sort of thing, too. I know you enjoy working with young people, don't you?
Absolutely. I always draw the kids in with basketball, but, you know, we want to teach life skills. So there's so much that they can get from us as we go along. And a partner of mine, as you guys know, Wayne Turner.
Oh, sure.
He's going to join me along this, you know, back then they used to call it barnstorming.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like that in a sense, but you're going to get more personal detailed training from Wayne and I. We're pretty excited about it.
Well, it sounds like an exciting project, and I'm sure that there'll be much more to come on that. Tell me about when you were in your formative years. Now, you grew up in the Bronx, right? And tell me about your early interest in sports and how you got into sports there.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I play a little bit of baseball, and I'm glad I did. You know, I played first and third. Great at that, but when it came time to bat, that was the problem.
That's the problem for a lot of guys, I think.
right. That ball was coming in. It was coming in hot.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, I decided to, you know, dibble and dabble in basketball. And I remember my elementary gym teacher coming up to me and saying, "Hey, are you a lefty?" And at that time, I didn't really know what I was, right or righty or lefty, but he convinced me to play some ball, and then from there, it just really took off for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you the kind of kid that was always playing something? Were you always out involved in activities and got interested in sports that way, or did you kind of have to be persuaded a little bit?
No, I was active. My mother, we had an agreement that once the light posts went out, that I had to be inside.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can see myself racing down the street as the light posts go out with my basketball so I wouldn't get in trouble. So, yeah, no problem with that. I was active and I was involved and I was always in the park or at buddy's backyard trying to hone my skills and just having fun as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Did you think about seeing the world at that time? Because you've certainly done that in your basketball career, but was that something that you had in mind as a child? I'd like to travel and see more of the world?
You know what? I sure didn't, but the greatest thing happened for me. I was able to get on a team that's recognized in New York, very famed team, New York City Gauchos. You know, you have greats, Jamal Mashburn, Rod Strickland, a lot of people who came from this program. And at a very young age, we were traveling to Germany. We were traveling to France. We were going to Bahamas and Hawaii. So I had a chance to really get some experience traveling. And who knew after graduating from University of Kentucky that I would be able to go on and continue that. It's almost like it was destined to happen.
Yeah. Now, obviously, if you're on a team like that, that's going to be some pretty good athletes. But was there a point in when you're growing up that you realized, I can really do something with basketball. This is going to be something that can take me to where I want to go. Was there some point when you realized I can be really good at this?
I think I really realized when I got on the Gauchos and playing with Stephon Marbury, God Shamgard, Felipe Lopez, and I can go on and go on. At that point, I started to realize that I did have some skill because I was learning from so much from these guys, and my game started to blossom.
And what age group was that when you were playing with those guys?
Well, I guess when I first got to the Gauchos, that might have been anywhere between 12 and 13. I was a little bit of a late bloomer because obviously kids start really young. So I was a late bloomer that just blossomed at the right time.
Yeah, and of course kids are different physically at that age too, but the names you mentioned, those guys, of course, developed into great ball players, and they must have had that talent pretty early in life, and then that gave you a chance to develop too.
Correct.
Now, you began your college career at Manhattan College under Coach Fran Fraschilla. That was close to home for you. Manhattan College is in the Bronx, right? Originally located in Manhattan, but moved to the Bronx a long time ago as it grew. But you started there at Manhattan, and that was, I guess, very close to home, right?
Right. And it's amazing because growing up, we lived in the projects right down the street from Manhattan College called Marble Hill Projects. So I went from Marble Hill to going to the North Bronx section, where we moved into a private house. And then I wind up going back to that area, Manhattan College. Mm-hmm. So, it's amazing to me every time I go back and I see that project where it started, not knowing that I was going to end up down the street at Manhattan College.
Yeah, that's interesting that you would start your college basketball career there. And, of course, Manhattan's a smaller school. Those who follow Kentucky basketball may not think of Manhattan as being a high-profile basketball school, but that's in the Metro Atlantic, and you had rivals like Iona and Fairfield and Loyola of Maryland, Canisius. There's some pretty good basketball played there. And I wanted to ask you about the atmosphere. Give me the name of the gymnasium and the kind of atmosphere there. Is it Draddy? Is that right? Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes. Draddy was a great atmosphere. As you know, you had about 4,500 enrollment in the school, but we packed that gym in tight. So when teams had to come in, it wasn't easy to play there. You know, we made a lot of noise. You know, Fran Fraschilla, you know, his meticulous scouting reports and preparation for those games, we were able to do some really good things in the Metro Atlantic Conference,
Yeah, you were the Rookie of the Year in the Metro Atlantic in 1995, about 12 points and 5 rebounds a game, so you contributed right away. Was there any experience there while you were at Manhattan really memorable? I know the games provided the great atmosphere, the students really turn out there, but anything, any particular game that you recall that really stands out in your mind about your time at Manhattan?
Well, I remember we were playing in our conference title, and this was to get a bid into the tournament. So we lost to St. Peter's, I believe it's by the buzzer. So we still went back and we watched the selection show, you know, with a little bit of hope that we would get in. But, you know, we had a great schedule and we beat some really good teams. And to see our names pop up on that screen, which I would imagine Coach already knew that we were going to go, but I guess he had to sit back so he can surprise us. And now we're in Memphis, in the same bracket, same region as Kentucky. So like I said, you know, I believe in divine intervention. This was all supposed to happen. And we wind up playing Oklahoma in the first round, and we won. So we were, you know, the Cinderella team. And then we lost to Arizona State, I believe, by 8 or 7 points, which Kentucky went on to beat them by 20 or 25 points.
Well, your first team All-Metro Atlantic in 1996, and obviously you had a good experience at Manhattan in that regard, but then decided to go ahead and transfer. Tell me about the transfer process ended up at UK. How did that all come about?
You know what? I was very lucky. After my freshman year, I went to the USA Olympic Festival. They took the best freshmen around the country, and I was able to play there for Calipari, believe it or not.
Wow.
And after that, sophomore season, we went to NIT and we played Wisconsin at their place. Tough place to play. They had a great All-American, Sam Oakey, and they wound up winning that game. So my coach went to St. John's. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I was thinking, wow, if Coach Fran is going to have this opportunity to leave, then I think it's best that I find a new home. Well, it's such a small world, because after my freshman year, I went to Kentucky to work basketball camp, and we decided that this was going to be good for me so I can hone my skills and come back and be stronger for our conference. And I got to know Rick. I got to know the players. So going back into the season, I was pretty strong. So the opportunity for me to go to Kentucky was unreal. Never thought it would happen. You know, the owner of the New York City Gauchos, Lou Dalmeida, you know, reached out, and we were trying to think, you know, what would be the next move. And, we were looking for schools. Of course, I wanted to go to Miami, Lennon Hamilton, but that didn't quite work out. And, you know, like a couple of weeks later, I got a phone call from my AAU coach, and he told me, you know, I think we may have a solution. So at that point, it was still unknown, but, obviously, I found out that I was going to have the opportunity to go to Kentucky, and I just couldn't believe it. You know, you're talking about going from a mid-major school to the contenders that just won a championship in 96. So,
sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I really don't know if that's ever been done before, but, you know, I was probably the first kid to go from a mid-major to a national champion. In Kentucky.
You may well be right. Yeah, they had won the championship, of course, with a great team in 96. Lost some guys off of that team, but then came back and made a run to the final game the next year during your transfer year. And I was going to ask you about that because things used to be, we might say, orderly. I don't know if it's entirely fair or not, but at that time the players had to sit out a year, and that's beginning to change now. A lot of waivers going on, and maybe a change permanently at some point. But things have changed a lot regarding transfers, especially during this pandemic time. But what did you gain from that transfer year where you're practicing every day but not able to play in the games?
That was the best thing for me. I think if I was able to come right in and play, I probably wouldn't have gotten any minutes because I wasn't ready for that caliber of play in the SEC. So sitting out and learning the system, working on my body, because when I first came in, I was about 180, 185. And I remember Rick Pitino saying, hey, is this guy sick? We got to put some weight on him. And so playing against guys like Ron Mercer and Derek Anderson and Allen Edwards every day, when they're scoring on you every single day, you have no choice but to get better. You're facing the best in the country. So when it was my turn, you know, things were a lot easier for me. So that year sitting out was really important for my transition into the SEC play and the SEC conference.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there was a coaching change at Kentucky then in the spring of 97 when Rick Pitino accepted an offer with the Celtics. You had been through that at Manhattan. What was your reaction when he decided to take that offer and leave Kentucky?
You know, it was kind of tough because I didn't understand at the time, but I figured it out later on. So when I saw the guys' faces and as we went around the room and we discussed that, you know, Rick was leaving and he was, you know, letting us all share how we felt about it. For me, you know, it was my foot in the door. So Rick Pitino leaving, it didn't really affect me as I thought it would, because I'm like, wow, you brought me here. So you leaving, you know, I'm still feeling a certain way about it, but I'm like, hey, I'm at Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I know they're going to bring someone else in here. So I figured either way, we were going to be fine.
And, of course, that someone turned out to be Coach Tubby Smith. And while he had been here before, it had been several years, he had built his own head coaching career and reputation. What was it like to get to know him and begin to play for him? Because everybody was in the same boat. Everybody was getting to know him as the head coach.
Tubby was a great coach. Tubby is that father figure that wants to make sure that you you present yourself well, you learn how to be a man, you make sure you groom yourself, but at the same time, make sure we get it done on the court and in the classroom, just as well as Rick did, but just a different approach, more of like a father figure, per se.
Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be something that was part of his personality that would come across in his public appearances, that he wanted that to happen, and he seemed to be he certainly was a man not without a sense of humor, but at the same time he was pretty businesslike in his approach to basketball and how you ought to handle being a college basketball player. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's you hit it on the nail there. It's pretty accurate. Yeah. And I think it's important because it's shaped us into the men that we are today.
Mm-hmm. Your team started very well, of course, in that what turned out to be a national championship season. Won 10 out of the first 11, then a loss to Louisville at Rupp Arena in December, and then you won 9 more in a row. At that stage of the season, when it was going very well, what were the strengths of the team at that point in the season? What do you recall about that?
Well, I probably need to call Cameron Mills because he has a memory like an elephant. But you know, I think what is most important is that I think after you have that break in the season and then you have all of the students leave and you're practicing every single day, just like Cal has his situation. I forgot what he calls it, but
Camp Cal really is what you're talking about. Yeah.
Camp. Exactly. Yeah. That's when you really have Camp Cal. That's when you really have the opportunity to gel as a team. So, you know, I think, although losing to Louisville, which will be considered a championship game because it's, I guess, bragging rights in the States, those games are necessary. So when you move on, you get rolling like we did. So those games that we continue to win is part of us losing that game and locking in and just gelling as a team on and off the court.
Mm-hmm. There was the last loss of the year came on Valentine's Day in 1998, lost to Ole Miss at Rupp Arena. That was unexpected, of course. And to show where expectations were, to get an idea of the context at that time, Kentucky had won the national championship with only 2 losses all year in 96, national runner-up with 5 losses in 1997. So a 22-4 mark, which is what it was at that time after that loss, to some fans, I guess that didn't look so good by comparison. But that was a home court loss. Lost to Ole Miss. What happened after that loss to really get things on the right track for the rest of the year? We've always heard about players meeting and getting together. What really was the key to getting things on the track toward the national championship at that time?
You know, those losses late in the season, I think they do really well because you never want to just keep rolling, because then you may get a loss a little bit later on when it's really important. But, you know, those team meetings when you have all the guys chime in and lock in and talk about what we need to do. And we would have those meetings without the coaches because that was very important. And once you do that, then it's like time to put your hard hat on and just go to work. And we were able to do that.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it was a matter of players seeing that they needed to do that, but not so much a matter of nobody was losing confidence in the coach or anything like that. Is that correct?
Oh, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. You know, Tubby has a system. We believe in it. But it's like I said, it's very important sometimes. Like, they give us the room, the opportunity to get together and say, hey, guys, we got to lock in. We have to get this done. And we did that, and we had we made some history.
Mm-hmm. Sure did. That was a great run to the championship. Included the big comeback game against Duke that fans still talk about around here, and probably will forever. What do you remember about that game?
Well, you know, the details are so important. What I remember about, let's say, the Duke game, or let's say Utah game, is that even if we're losing at halftime, we would run into that locker room as if we were up by 30. And that is so important. And I try to tell kids that details do matter, because that can take the life out of a team, knowing that a team is looking and saying, we've beaten these guys and they're still won't give in. So I think those little details is what really determines the outcome of some of these games.
Now, of course, you had a fine senior year at Kentucky, the second leading scorer behind Scott Padgett, and it was very close. You were just under 12 points a game. He was just over 12 points a game. Another good team that made a good run in the tournament. But looking back, though, on 98, a final question about the national championship year. When you're celebrating, you would have had time to reflect a little bit and think about the transfer from Manhattan College and then getting on a team that goes on to win the national championship. You're on the floor just after the victory. What's going through your mind at that time?
Well, the first thing I did, I looked over at Fran Fischella because he's sitting on the opposite end. I had no idea he was going to be there, so that was a great moment for me, but you know, as I look back and I watch the tapes and I see the pictures, you know, no one sees me on the floor, because as soon as that happened, it felt like everything was in slow motion and I just bellied my way up into the crowd to go hug my mother and my family that was there. So it's just funny now that I look back and I recall those moments. I'm not even in those pictures because I had to run up to the family and, you know, it was the greatest feeling ever. I just feel like everything was moving in slow motion. And it's like that, almost that out of body experience where you're looking down and you're watching this happen. And it's just in slow motion. That's the best way that I can explain it. Such a great feeling.
And you talked about how you react, say, if you're behind at halftime, and Kentucky was behind at halftime at that game and had to come from behind in the second half. So you did have to put that into practice there, where you go off the floor at halftime with some confidence and come back out ready to go for the second half, because it was a great comeback and I think may still be the best comeback after halftime in a championship game.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I don't know about my other teammates, but I kind of watch the games occasionally and I always think like, wow, look what we've accomplished, you know, and to have that name, the Comeback Cats, you know, because, you know, each team, you know, had a name. So it just lives with us. And when we do get together or we're on the phone, we talk about it occasionally. Of course, we talk about our lives and what we have going on, but we still chime in on those moments.
Well, I mentioned your very solid senior year, so you certainly had established yourself as a key player on a national championship team and then a very successful team the next year. But then it's over. The college career is over, and it's time to turn pro if you can and if you want to, and if you want to move ahead with your plans to play professional basketball. What was it like then coming out in the spring of 99, and what did you think was ahead for you at that time?
Well, at that time, I just, in my mind, I know I solidified opportunity to play in overseas. That I knew. I just had the feeling, you know. And obviously, I had dreams on trying to get into the NBA. And it didn't quite work out. But the biggest thing for me is that I had created an opportunity for my family and I to see the world. And even for my son, traveling at 3 years old, seeing his dad play in Portugal, playing in France, Japan, Spain, you know, it's one of the biggest things that I could ever dream for. You know, getting that experience, being cultured, hearing people speak in another language, mm-hmm. you know, that's something that carries over and can hold on with him for the longest. So, I mean, having that experience that I had with the Gauchos, with traveling around the world, I was ready. I was ready. I was ready to take on whatever came my way and played in a lot of continents. But being in Europe and being in Portugal, that was my home. You know, I was able to do some great things there. Won 6 championships there with 4 different clubs. I was able to obtain a Portuguese citizenship and also speak Portuguese as well. So it's definitely a blessing, and I'm happy that I can continue to still share some of these stories with kids, letting them know that there's a lot out there that you can see if you put your mind to it and you work really hard at whatever you're doing, whether it's basketball or you're working to be an engineer, you're working to be a social worker. You can really get some stuff done if you put your mind to it. And it's the perfect thing. You know, I came from the Bronx, New York, and I worked my tail off, and I was able to play for the Kentucky Wildcats. That in itself is inspiring, I think, for many. And I'm happy that you're allowing me to share this with the masses.
Well, certainly glad to have you with us to do that. I wanted to ask you about playing in those different countries. And also, I know you had the saying, travel is the antidote to ignorance on your Twitter account. And there are a lot of people who certainly believe in that, who have traveled extensively. Tell me about the interactions. Let's say your first stop was in France. Is that right?
Right.
Tell me about the interactions with the French people that you got to know and how that worked out for you, because that was your first year as a professional overseas.
Yeah, that was my first stop. And that was interesting because, you know, with the French, they welcome you, but they expect you to speak their language. Mm-hmm. So as I've made different stops and I would go to places to try to order food and I haven't quite figured out how to speak French yet, they didn't give you a pass for that. So that motivated me to go ahead and learn some French. And it also motivated me. And I also understood how important it was to be one with the culture, you know? So I had my baguette. I was walking down the street with my baguette, doing as the French do, and as well as just really diving in the culture and learning how to live as a French person would do. And I think that made my transition easier my first year in France.
Now, you played in Japan as well. You get to Japan and you not only got the language barrier, but at least in France, you can look at a menu and maybe figure out what things are in Japanese. Everything looks different too. What was the adaptation there like?
Well, I must say, having the experience of traveling, when I got to Japan, it was a little bit of a culture shock. So, phone bill was a bit high, calling it home a lot, trying to let everyone know what's going on here and, I haven't quite built friends yet. But the greatest thing about that, we did have a translator named Paul. He came out of, I think, the University of Houston, and he helped us so much because, you know, just when wanting to order something, we had to give him a call and he would get it done. Or if we need to go somewhere and order something, that helped a lot. Mm-hmm. Now, the only way that didn't help, you know, I guess you get a little bit lazy when you need to learn some Japanese, because you always have Paul there for you.
What about the fans there? I know I've seen Japanese baseball, of course, and they're just extremely enthusiastic about that. And did they welcome you, and did the fans enjoy watching you play?
Yes, they welcomed me in open arms. You know, what was interesting that we never really had a home court because all our games were played on a neutral site. But everywhere we went to play, you know, whether it be the people from the companies that were there, they loved it. You know, that I guess that was their escape from work, you know, because we all know they put in very long hours over there. Mm-hmm. So when they came out to support the games, they really made it a great atmosphere.
I wanted to ask you about Portugal, of course, because you made your home there for many years. But you also mentioned some experience in Angola, and many people speak Portuguese there in Angola. But that's, of course, an African country that has had a history of some civil war fairly recently. But I guess that situation is somewhat stabilized. What was it like when you were there? What did you get from that experience?
That was such a great experience because that was the first time that I ever stepped foot in Africa. So Angola being somewhat of the sister country to Portugal, because I see that the Portuguese countries tend to stick with one another. And you would know, if you were living in Angola, you would know what was going on in Portugal, as well as Mozambique and Guinea-Bissau and type of bird. So that opportunity came about, and it was the best thing ever. You know, the fans there absolutely love basketball. You could be winning by 30 or losing by 20, and they are still going to be playing the drums and singing songs as if you were winning the game by 60 points.
Yeah.
It played 48 minutes like the NBA. And just getting the opportunity to learn more about Angola, Luanda, living there, the food, the people, the culture, the dancing, I really, really soaked all of that in. Because I will say this, growing up, what I did see on TV on how they depicted Africa wasn't necessarily what I saw when I was there. So that was definitely an eye-opening experience for me. And I still have relationships that I forged there, guys that I speak to all the time, but in Portuguese.
Right, right. Was there any particular experience there, any one particular interaction with people or an event or something like that that might stick with you as far as your experience in Angola and your time there?
Well, that's a great question. I think for me, being American at this time, I was in Portuguese and going to Angola and being accepted by the people, I think was the biggest thing, because not only did they see me as an American, but the fact that I actually spoke Portuguese and I tried to learn their way of Portuguese, because it's really different when you look at Portuguese from Portugal opposed to Brazil and Angola. It's just like our English opposed to the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Learning how to speak as they do and just really diving in to the culture. I continue to say that because I think it's very important, because it makes the transition so much easier. So when I left Angola and I went to play in Portugal for one of the biggest soccer teams, Benfica, in Portugal, in Europe, we went back to Angola to play in a tournament, which is called the Taça de Campal. And when I went back, how the people received me was the greatest feeling ever. It's like as if I never left. And that made me feel really special about my time there in Luanda, Angola.
Mm-hmm. And now, did you say soccer a minute ago?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I played for a team called Benfica, which is a well-renowned soccer club in Europe. But of course, I played for the basketball team, but I represented that whole club, which is a huge club in Europe.
Okay. Yeah. So after the experience in Angola, you, of course, made your home long-term in Portugal. Tell me what appealed to you about Portugal, where you thought this is a place that I can be for a long time.
What was so appealing, for one, is right on the coast. So everywhere you turn, you have a beach. and that's amazing for me. And Portugal is a very small country, but the people are very nice. Living in the north of Portugal and then going to Lisbon and then going to the south of Portugal, it's just very beautiful. And the food is amazing. The cobblestone roads, the castles. It's just the climate. It's just truly amazing to me. And I could have gone on early in my career to play in bigger countries like Spain, but I was very comfortable with being in Portugal. So I decided to stick around there, and I'm glad I did. Very, very good moments there.
Now, bringing it all back here, and as you mentioned, starting the new program here, we'll get you to tell us about that again, but also wanted to ask you about talking to young people. Now that you have all this international experience, how will you bring that into your program to address young people here and maybe give them an idea of what life is like in some other countries and what people are like there?
Right. Obviously, with COVID, that kind of puts a halt on things because I like the face-to-face interactions when I'm able to speak with kids and also different companies. But 2 years ago, when I was in Kentucky, before I decided to go back and play another year of professional basketball at 44, I had a lot of opportunities to go into Rupp Arena, to go into the campus as well, and speak to people about my experiences. It was really, really therapeutic for me, and it was great to see that the people were really interested to know what life was like in basketball outside of playing in the NBA. Because I think when you look at Kentucky, you know, of course they still love their players, but they always tend to talk about the NBA and where the Wildcats have been. But to be able to represent Kentucky basketball from an overseas European, African, Asian standpoint, I felt that needed to be done. So, you know, there's a lot of things that I have growing up, which is perfect. Plenty of time to do it during these times. And once this is relieved with COVID, I'm going to get out there and be able to really, really, implement the plan.
And give me the name of the program again. You and Wayne Turner will be the heading of.
Well, the name of the group that I'm associated with is PSG, Players Sports Group. And under this umbrella, we have a lot of different things that we're going to do and we're going to bring to the state of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And come on, Keith, that's all I can give you, man.
Oh, I understand. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure we get the name out there so people know what to look for. So I'm sure there'll be a variety of things, and you've had a variety of experiences in your life, and I'm sure you'll be able to bring that to whatever you do in the future. Hashimu, it's been a pleasure talking with you today, and appreciate you taking the time to be on with us.
Keith, I really appreciate you, and I would just like to say during these times, I wish everyone stays safe, and you know, God bless you, and thank you for allowing me to be here.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.